children's safety, education and training authority. Secretary of the Portfolio Committee, is there any apologies for this meeting?
Thank you, Chair. We receive apologies from Ms. Gina, Mr. Ligeto, Mr. Buenamo, as well as Ms. Kubuza. Thank you, Chair.
I think Ms. Kubai also sent out, we know that she's from the youth function in Mexico. So, okay, the secretary is saying that she office didn't submit a formal apology. But I know she went boarded on Friday, I think, last week. Members, we will continue. I also need to indicate that I, in fact, decided to come, but I'm supposed to since Monday already in bed. So I've got some serious flu. But it was good that I actually came, because otherwise we would have had one less member. So I'm here for this meeting, and I was probably then going to go back. But let me thank the insurance seater for joining us. I will allow you now to introduce yourself. This is the type of engagement that we're having to A, understand properly the workings of not only the seaters from a theoretical angle or from a generic space, as the department already has briefed us, but now to zoom in on the individual seaters and to, in a sense, get to the workings of the seater, to analyze it properly, then to look at is the work of the seater in this particular case aligned with the developmental objectives of the democratic dispensation. Are we able to see the career growth trajectory in terms of post-school environment within what you are presenting? Now, we've submitted a question in the beginning of the year, quite a loaded few questions to understand precisely from an administrative and an internal to a developmental impact of what CETAs, and in particular your CETA also would be doing and engaged on. So that's the backdrop to it. We know that there is a draft energy strategy. We know that there is a process of re-engineering. We know that in a space of uncertainty, that at times you can either move too fast or you can't move at all. And that's some of the, for example, engagements that we were reflective of as we're sitting here. So that is a backdrop. Most probably we want to ask the seater just to introduce themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. To introduce my team first, I'd have to make an apology, which we did formally in writing. Our CEO, Sandra Dunn, is booked off with bronchitis, as well as our chair and deputy chair are not available to attend this meeting. My name is Sharon Snell. I'm the Chief Operations Officer of INSETA. I'm here together with my team. First, I'd like to introduce you to our council member. He's resident in Cape Town. Sorry, this.
Use another mic, please. There you are.
Thank you. If I could firstly introduce our member of council that is here. He's resident in Cape Town. He's Mr. Terence Berry. He's representative of a body called ASISA on the INSETA Council. Then I'd like to introduce my colleague, Tumi Pile. She's our Learning Division Manager. And we're also joined by Berna Boerter. She's representing our outsourced financial management partner, Deloitte. And that's our team for today. Thank you.
Good. Then you can proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. documents that have been copied for the committee is firstly the presentation that is up on the screen. Secondly, we have a document entitled the In Situ Business Plan 2010 to 2015. That is a document that we submitted last year in September to the department and the relevant divisions as our business plan. Following thereon, we had a further strat session with the new council, and there's a second document entitled The Turnaround Continued, and it was responding to a particular need, a changeover of management, change in council, etc., and to a certain extent it updated the other document, and I'll take the members through it in my presentation. And then lastly, we prepared a list of our accredited training providers, which I shall deal with. Thank you. My presentation roadmap is firstly going to cover who we are as In Situ. Next, we'll deal with the background to the insurance sector. Then we'll cover the mandate, budget, strategic plans, and SWOT analysis of 2010-11. Then following that would be the budget analysis of the previous financial year, which we regard as year 10, and then provincial allocations and special projects for 2010. Thereafter, plans to reduce the high unemployment rate among young people, and lastly, learning provider list, which is attached, but I will touch on it. We put the presentation roadmap to match up with the deliverables that was requested for us in the notice, the invite notice to this meeting. So I will be covering the areas that has been specifically requested of us. Firstly, I would like to take you through In Situ's new purpose, which we'd gone through January 2010 this year, and more details of it is in the document entitled The Turnaround. In Situ's purpose is to grow the pool and quality of scarce and critical skills in the insurance sector, enhancing the sector and supporting the country's transformation. We reviewed our values, and we made our values very specific. One of the things that we said as a team is, you know, you see a lot of these words in values, and they mean nothing to you. Let's chuck them away, and let's start with what do we actually want to achieve and translate that into a value. And that's why you see that our values are very specific to In Situ. The first value there is partner to enable others. That is the most critical value that we feel is important to be able to achieve our objectives. And the idea here is that we really have come a long way in the past 10 years. And at this point, we were looking at forming strategic partnerships to be able to accelerate and massify on skills development, which is the call of the new Department of Higher Education. And in this regard, we had to form those strategic partnerships and alliance to be able to achieve our goals. Secondly, to be an employer of choice, to consult and collaborate with stakeholders. The next value was to lead with vision. We want to develop contemporary solutions to guide the industry. We don't want to be dictating to our industry. Our industry is leaders in various fields. As when I go through the subsectors, one would be able to pick up where they lead in. And what we really want to be able to do is to be able to guide the industry specifically relating to skills development and work together with them. Listen, learn, influence, and shape. To deliver quality, In Situ has a green status with SAQWA, so we have already been delivering quality. We want to continue to do so, but the idea here is we're looking for results for real impact. We're moving away from what we were doing perhaps in the first 5 to 7 years, where a lot of training was happening, but there wasn't real impact happening. You couldn't measure at the end of the day that a person received a qualification within the set time, has exited the system with that qualification, and then could perhaps, if you track that person, has been promoted and has moved through the system as a result of the impact. So we want to see more impact in the type of learning that we deliver. And then secondly, value for investment. We want to make sure that we get the best value, the most economic we will spend our money to make sure that we have to maximize how many people benefit at the end of the day from the limited funds that we have. So it's a lot of thought went into it about nice to haves And then what would you look at as being critical for people to have, and how can you deliver more with the available funding that you do have? And I'll touch upon it a bit later. The last value we wanted to put in there was to inspire trust, and that is common to most organizations. We regarded being transparent as quite important, to be reliable and consistent. What you hear from us today, you will hear from us tomorrow. We won't see your face and tailor-make a solution for you and things like that. Everyone would be treated the same. We are all partners in the same journey. And then lastly, the accountability part of it. Underpinning all of this high-level vision is the alignment with government's medium-term strategic framework and the human resource development strategy. At the back of the incentive business plan, we have outlined exactly where the alignment is. We've detailed each item on the strategy and matched it up with where the in-situ alignment is. Even though, as a Department of Higher Education, we're focusing on a particular item relating to skills, but we've matched it up and tried to identify almost in each area what are we doing towards that particular item on the framework. And then what we've pulled through are our key areas that we're going to be touching in. We call them the strategic pillars. Our strategic pillars consist of, first and foremost, the youth problem, youth development, then your SMME development. We'll then be touching on research and benchmarking, scarce and critical skills, and then social transformation. So everything that we approve in terms of discretionary grant funding must talk to those strategic pillars. If somebody proposes a project and that gets looked at by council, they measure it up against those strategic pillars as well as the National Skills Development Framework, which we have a one-year plan with the Department of Labor. Now, I haven't attached the service level agreement that we have with the department because that's generic to all CETAs, but that's also an important document for us. At the time of putting our strategy together, we simply had the draft National Skills Development Document 3. We didn't have the finalized version. So we worked a lot on what was out there and including the basis of NSDS 2. As we stand today, NSDS 3 has not yet been finalized. But there's a lot of things that are coming through which we've already put into our strategy and are trying to align with that. Okay. We were also asked to put up a profile of the in-situ council together with the capacity which they act, what constituency they come from, and the gender and race. If we could start with our chairperson, Ivan Mzimela. He's representing Labor. It's a union in the insurance called IBSA. He's also a director at Hollard Insurance. Then our deputy chairperson is Mr. Rama Govindan. And he's a representative from ASISA. It's the same organization Mr. Terence Berry is from. And that's followed by Barry Scott, and he's representing the South African Insurance Association. As you want to go through the detail of it. Are you comfortable with that? Thanks. And then I've included a slide dealing with the profile of in-situ management and the equity profile that was requested. Can I pass that as well? The next slide deals with the size and scope of the sector. Before I go into the slide, what I want to say is this is just information from our Workplace Skills Plan annual training report submitted in 2008. We're currently doing the SSP based on the June 2009 information. One must bear in mind that there are 1,400 levy-paying organizations that are within our sector. In 2008, we had just 373 WSPs to work off for this particular data. That's obviously upped an increase now to over 700. But this information must just be born from the fact that it's just WSP information. It's not information reflective of the whole sector, including non-levy paying. So we have over 137,000 people employed in the sector within these particular companies. And the sector is broken down into different subsectors, the first being unit trust, risk management, insurance and pension fund, life insurance, then pension fund as a separate category, healthcare benefits and administration, short-term insurance, funeral insurance, reinsurance, and activities that are auxiliary to the insurance industry. We, as a sector, are dominated by women. More than half of the people in the sector are women, and we find that the sector is quite a rapidly growing sector, and there's increases in the number of people that are being employed in the sector all the time. At our previous, the previous SSP that we did, the increase was over 37,000 people because that was pitched at 100,000 based on the WSP information. So one can see through the through more WSP information coming through, we're able to get a clearer picture of the industry itself. Okay. This is an educational profile of the insurance sector from the table there. We can see that we're dealing with a sector that's becoming increasingly professional. You hardly find people with no schooling or less than primary completed in our sector. There's a big portion of people that do have tertiary education, bachelor's degrees and diplomas, and have completed secondary education.
What is 34%?
The 34% are people that have tertiary education.
Okay.
Yes. This particular table deals with employment growth in the sector, and if you have a look at the last table, you'll see that we are increasing over the five-year period the growth of black people in employment in the insurance sector. There has been a higher growth of black females as opposed to white females in the sector, and as I've mentioned already, more than half of the employees in the sector are women.
And just a question, if you refer to employees, you then mean people that work for themselves?
No, people that are employed in the sector, in the insurance houses, in the different subsectors we spoke about.
So not individual brokers that are doing agency work?
It's very difficult to get data on individual brokers that are not linked to a big company because they fall under the compulsory figure to submit WSPHRs. They're actually non-levy paying companies. So that's why I'm distinguishing my data, saying what data we're drawing out of WSP information. And then now we're looking at data from the labor force survey for the particular insurance sector, and that's for the wider insurance sector. And if you look at the data for it matches. There's similarities with the data that we're picking up from our WSP information that we're getting through. The next table deals with the national footprint of the sector. When I was reviewing my presentation last night, I picked up that we just mixed up the headings on Western Cape and Northern Cape. So Northern Cape is actually Western Cape. So if you have a look at the table, you'll see that primarily our workers are focused in Gauteng. That's where the big insurance houses are, followed by Western Cape and then KwaZulu-Natal. This becomes very important in some of the responses that we put together to address youth unemployment, and I'll discuss that in a later slide. Just on a high level, the insurance CETA gets its mandate out of the Skills Development Act. And just what we have to achieve is to make sure that we are monitoring the workplace skills plans. We've got to develop and implement and monitor the insurance skills plan research document. That is a document that we put together annually. This sector skills plan contains the roadmap, really, for the skills required in the insurance sector. It details all the research findings that we have. It tells us what the scarce and critical skills that are needed in the sector, and it deals with how we're going to address them. So annually, we have to produce this document, and we produce it from research that we have, desktop research that we have, from WSPHR data that we analyze, and then we go outside of that and look at the market and do surveys, with people, etc., to supplement the information so that the information is not restricted to just the levy paying companies that have submitted WSP information. Okay. And then we also act as an E2QA, that's an Education and Training Quality Authority. We have to fulfill that role vis-a-vis the providers that have been registered to provide qualifications by the insurance CETA. Then we have to perform any functions delegated by the QCTL. Currently, there's nothing delegated by the QCTL. Then we establish, promote, and register learnerships in the industry, and we disperse skills development levies in the sector. The way we disperse our discretionary grant levies, as I indicated on the first slide I dealt with, is through our strategies. And it has to comply with the national skills development framework that we have, as well as what the Institute strategy is and the five pillars that we have to address, which we regard as key in our sector. Okay. I've just put one slide dealing with the 2010-11 budget. This is the budget that we have put together for the year, anticipating what levies we will be receiving. And if you look at line 3, that is the balance, the 80% after we've taken out the NSF portion. And we've also added 15 million rand in interest and other income, leaving us with 214 million rand as a total income. We expect to pay as a refund on 50% grant repayments to companies of 113 million rand. Our administration is managed within 10% of the amount, and we've budgeted 23 for that. And we will then be left over with a figure of 77 million to then spend on discretionary grant funding. Where companies on the first item grant expenditure do not claim back their mandatory grants, that money automatically goes to discretionary grants, and it will then inflate the money that is available for discretionary grant spending. Okay. This is just a table dealing with the mandate, the budget, the strategic plans, and the SWOT analysis of INSETA. I will then refer you to our INSETA business plan. I have covered the mandate. We did a high-level SWOT analysis, which you would see on page 8 and page 9. I'm just going to take you through certain aspects of it, not this full SWOT analysis, but what we regard as key. First and foremost was, as an organization whose license had expired, and at that point in time we just had a one-year renewal, very important to us in terms of long-term planning was the whole re-licensing process. And our response to that was we regarded it as an opportunity to then position ourselves as a leading CETA through the massification of service delivery and pioneering research. As I said before, we've done 10 years already, and what we were really looking at now is how can we make sure what we're doing and all the lessons learned in how we were doing things like learnerships, bursaries, etc., how can we use the same money to benefit more people, to respond to the call of massification of service delivery. And then we also had some issues with negative stakeholder perceptions of INSETA, but that goes throughout all the CETAs. And we said we are going to respond with open and honest communication of our governance initiatives and a publicity campaign to build positive perceptions and trust. One of the things we identified is that we weren't going to go and take up lots of money and spend on advertorials and advertising ourselves in a grandiose manner, because that's not what public funds are there for. We have a specific communication campaign that deals with making sure the public is aware of our successes and throwing that out into the bigger domain, and that gets picked up by the newspapers fairly well. So it's a very active management of our PR as a CETA to build a trust in and sort of deflate the negative perceptions that are out there. We also had key on our agenda was a levy reduction as a result of the long-term effects of the global economic meltdown. In the first few years, we didn't really see much happening there. But as we expected, what was happening is the companies were pulling together and tightening up as opposed to retrenching staff, which would reduce the levies. But now, in the past year, we are beginning to see that there are some retrenchments happening. They're not massive-scale retrenchments happening. There might be a little bit of effect on our levy income, but we haven't as yet seen that come through definitely. We have put in a response to deal with training layoffs, and we've advertised that out quite a bit. Our response is in terms of our bursary project, whereby we upskill people that have been retrenched to make sure that they are employable still in the sector, and sometimes maybe outside the sector, but they get skills to then make them employable. And we have worked already with one particular company, Swiss Re, that has done retrenchments. We are in the process of upskill training for their staff, and we've also assisted them in making their CVs more employable, and we've circulated their CVs to other companies in the sector to make sure they get priority in employment when people are being employed in the sector. We further, saw an opportunity to review our structure, overall our cost centers and activities, to be more prudent and efficient in the use of funds and resources. So that's coming through quite strongly in almost everything the INSITA is doing to become more economic and efficient. There has been an increased demand on discretionary grant funds as a result of employer budget cuts on skills development. We picked that up in the research that we did last year, that because employers were not retrenching, what they would be looking at is reducing the amount of money that they do spend on training, which means that there would be more demand on the CETA funds. And we're already seeing that coming through. This has really been a reality in the past 12 months. And our response to be more economical is talking directly to that as well. Another threat we saw was the reduction of pace of transformation of the sector as a result of the employers spending cuts and rationalizing staff. As we know, to fast-track women, to fast-track black people, to fast-track disabled people costs far more than sending a normal person on a course. And employers were paying a premium to do that, but we were aware that this was going to be reduced as a result of people cutting back on funds. And INSITA has used its bursary fund to ensure that these programs are still out there, they're still going to be running, and to fill that gap, to make sure that there wouldn't be a lag on the transformation in the sector. Another issue that we face as a CETA is opportunistic legal claims for funding from training providers. We have had a number of claims from training providers where training was done without authority, etc. And that was quite a thing, important thing for the INSITA Council to address. And we've put clear policies and processes for funding applications in place, and we re-looked at the way we deal with bursaries as a result of the problems there. And the last external sort of SWOT we looked at was not meeting our mandate to provide skills development opportunities aligned with all provincial growth and development strategies. And that was a big area for us. We struggle with the provincial presence. And the reason, therefore, is the provincial partners, the provincial growth and development divisions are not really that active. You find in some provinces they are, in some provinces they're not. And also in terms of training providers, especially private training providers, go where the demand is, where the companies are. So they're not prepared to train in remote places. And what we're doing is we started a partnership with the FET colleges, the public FET colleges, and maybe Tumi can talk a little bit more to it later because she handles that. The idea is that we capacitate the colleges who have a presence nationally and in the remote areas to be able to deliver our programs so that learners don't have to come to the city to try and get, and have all those unnecessary expenses just to be able to do a program in the sector. And we can perhaps deliver it there using the small brokerages in the area to manage the learnerships and the internships and have a fit solution that one can have a presence in the regions. That's not very advanced. That is still at the preliminary stages, but that's our response to extending our footprint in some of the remote areas. I'm just going to highlight on two internal threats. The first was a delay in service delivery as a result of some of our critical functions being outsourced, which was project management, and there were some systems issues which we looked at. We have since insourced our project management back into the NCETA, and that's working fairly well. Then we have the infrastructure support issue, which we have consolidated as a spot there. I'm not going to take you through the rest. They standard sort of threats that one would look at in an institution. Okay. And then we were asked to just give a brief analysis of the previous year 10's budget. And this is what the slide is dealing with. We found last year that our levy income was resilient despite global conditions, and we exceeded budget by 8% from what we had budgeted from. And then through close management of spending, NCETA ended the year with an administrative surplus of 3.4 million. And we just want to highlight that our admin expenditure is always managed within our 10%. 107 million rand was allocated to discretionary projects in year 10. We did receive 9 years of unqualified audit reports. And the investment management that we do it prudently. We have a policy in place, and we do it in short fixed-term deposits with the four SA banks. And we have a policy not to put more than 40% in one particular institution.
Can I just ask the question, just go back to the 107 in the discretionary project in year 10, is that cumulatively or just in the 10th year?
Just for the financial year. And then I prepared this table relating to provincial allocations and special projects. What the members must bear in mind is we don't have a particular project that only runs in one province. So what I've done is I've just pulled through some of the special projects, and I've pulled through some of the projects that have a wide provincial spread so that we could talk to it. The first is our SMME project. We have in this project regional advisors who are in the 9 provinces, and the regional advisors are the NCETA presence in the province, and they're able to provide support to stakeholders on the full range of NCETA services in the provinces, the priority being to support the SMME brokers. Then we have our career guidance project. This project also focuses on the 9 provinces. In fact, every single school in South Africa gets targeted by this project, where we deliver career guidance to them. We deliver career guidance brochures for the learners in grade 11 and grade 12. And we also make sure that the teachers, the guidance teachers, have the detailed career guidance brochures for the learners. We have another project called Partnering with South African Actuary Development Program. Here we... Actuaries have been highlighted as a scarce and critical skill in South Africa, more particular black actuaries. This particular project partners with SAAD, and SAAD has a special project whereby they don't just, it's not just about giving a black learner a bursary. It's a full service of support, coaching, mentoring through the whole qualification for the learner. Because the actuary is such a high-level qualification, and there's such a high level of dropouts. So what the SAAD have done is they've analyzed what are the reasons that black learners drop out of this particular program. And they've put in place measures and systems and coaching and mentors for the learners to make sure they're monitored almost on a monthly basis throughout the learner's experience in the qualification, thereby making sure the learner stays in the program. The learner graduates at the end of the day, and you have an actuary, and you don't have a high level of dropouts. This is what this particular project is looking at. And then we've had three particular phase projects. I've just combined it into one there. I didn't want to add all of that. It's worth 18 million rand. What we've done here, because phase was a compliance issue, and it is so critical to the industry to achieve their phase credits, particularly the black brokers, we put together this project to assist the industry to achieve their credits. What we did is we appointed a service provider to roll out RPL exams nationally in all the 9 provinces to ensure everyone gets their credits. We then moved on now to the second phase of phase. And that's for the regulatory exams that has been run by FSB. INSEAD has designed the learning material for all the RE exams, and most of them are available. There are about 14 of them. I think we've done about 10 so far. So that the examination material is available to all training providers in South Africa, whether you're in the insurance sector or you're outside the insurance sector, so that there's consistency and there's a standard which makes sure that at the end of the day, the learners that write the FSB exams would be able to pass and not have to rewrite, therefore reducing the number of people there. This is very critical for especially employed people that are in the sector to retain their licenses. So it's one of INSEAD's key projects that we deliver. What we will then be doing is further assisting the black brokers with special examination sessions as well as training on the learning material to ensure that they also get fast-tracked. We experienced previously in the previous 30-60 credit requirement with the FSB that the black brokers came on board almost in the last 12 months because they weren't really properly consulted. So now right up front we have done the consultation and we're going to make sure that they go through at the same time with everybody else and don't have the hiccups they had in the previous session. We also ran a special project with the Institute of SA. What happened here was there were tens of thousands of learners that had been abandoned at various stages of their qualifications because the College of Insurance had closed down. And we had made a commitment together with the IISA to get all those learners out of the system and to get them to complete the qualifications. It was quite a huge project, and we managed to get all the learners out, have issued their qualifications, and those learners have now been rescued. They are on the NLRD. We also have social development projects. It supports NGOs in the nine provinces, mostly highlighting things that are relevant, training that is relevant for NGOs. They put a proposal to the INSEAD, and we examine their proposal and approve funding for them. Another social transformation issue that we deal with is your burial societies. There are over 100,000 burial societies in South Africa. They fall under the insurance sector, and they've mainly been not part of what is happening in terms of the changes in legislation that is affecting them and in terms of becoming a bit more in the formalized sector, and that's because the Friendly Societies Act didn't particularly address their needs. We now have in place for them bursaries so that they can register as cooperatives, become a little bit more formalized. We're giving them governance training following a national indaba we held in March 2010, and we're making sure that their training needs from a burial society point of view is being met, especially in the point of view of them developing and becoming economically sustainable and entering new ventures and creating new ventures for themselves. We have the bursary and bursary top-up project. This also rolls out in nine provinces. INSEAD's mode of operating bursaries has changed as a result of our strategy change. We were mainly driven by service providers, training providers before. We have changed our bursary policy. We are now employer-driven and driven according to our scarce and critical skills resources. So we don't now engage with training providers and provide them with bursary funding. We engage directly with employers. Employers apply for the funding, and it has to be in compliance with our scarce and critical skills. Where we do engage with training providers, it's only to deal with your public HETs, that's your universities, and your further education and training colleges. So we've aligned completely to deal with the public institutions in that regard. Okay, and then we also had a special disability project which we ran last year, and it's also running this year in year 10. The idea behind this project is that we launched the first National Disability Award that was to commemorate International Disability Day and also to commemorate the work that the sector had been doing to increase the stats. I'm sure members of this committee saw the newspaper articles last year which showcased that INSEAD had achieved on the targets that we had for disabilities. We had overachieved by 299% on that. So the sector is really one of those sectors that's very suitable to employ disabled people, and that's why we showcased it by launching the first National Disability Awards. What we also running at the same time is a special internship for intellectually disabled learners. Now, as you're aware, people with intellectual disabilities can't really get a proper matric. They aren't proper qualifications for them. And we created this special internship taking that into in mind, and the internship is running over 12 months. The idea behind this internship is that we select the workplaces for them. We go into the workplaces first. We carve out a job for them. We take a number of people's jobs, and we pull out the routine task in each person's job and carve a job for an intellectually disabled person. Then we go in, we do the awareness training in the institution, and then we put in the disabled person there with intellectual challenges, and that person is given on-site coaching together with our partner, the Living Link, and that is running very successfully at the moment as a pilot project. Our plans to reduce the high unemployment rate among the youth, which is a slide that we had to cover. We spent hours discussing this issue at the council's flat session. It's a burning issue for CETAs, because if you just take, for example, the outcomes of our sector skills plan research, it says on new jobs, the sector can create 2,500 to 3,000 new jobs per year. That's not going to deal with the unemployment rate at all. If that's the absorption rate of the sector, it means that one has to start beginning to think out of the box. How do we think beyond this 2,500? We can't just take those amounts of people in. Just take the learnerships that we're doing. That runs into thousands, the internships, et cetera. There must be a better way of getting new people into the sector, and we have been strategizing around this. Our responses have been funding for internship programs to expose unemployed graduates to the workplace and in turn increase their chance for employment. Now, our take-up for learnerships and our take-up for internships is very, very high, and we have a good rollout. We finish within 12 months and the qualifications awarded. So we've got that down to a very good, well-oiled machine within the sector. And the preferred method, especially at certain levels of employment, is actually to take people that have gone through a learnership or an internship. And we've now included in our policies that when you apply for a learnership, you've got to actually show us from last year how many people have you taken in. And if you come, we are quite comfortable that it's about a 70 to 80% take in, then one can give more learners to that particular employer company to make sure that people are not using learnerships and internships just for to get a credit and say I'm doing it, but are actually using it for what the intention is, and that's to create decent work for people. And it is happening in our sector. It's not at 100% that one would, but it's at a good rate. It's around 70%. Bursaries for unemployed graduates to create a talent pool for the sector. As we said, we are in partnerships with the public FETs and HETs, your BCom degrees, actuarial science, those things that would get people employed in the sector regarded as scarce and critical skills. We offer bursaries to unemployed learners in that regard to make sure the sector has its own talent pool. One of the issues that comes out as a burning issue when one speaks to CEOs and also in the SSP research is that from the point of view of competition for highly qualified people, like people with BCom degrees, etc., the sector competes with the broader financial services sector. Because insurance is not regarded as so glamorous, we don't get the best people, and we really have to fight for people or pay a premium for them. So employers are very comfortable with creating their own pool of people that are specific to the insurance sector. So when you do a BCom insurance or a BCom financial planning, and you know that you've chosen the sector through the funding of the CETA as your home, as your career of choice. We also provide career guidance opportunities in the insurance sector. We partner with companies in the insurance sector through funding training of learners in new venture creation with the aim of giving the learners the opportunity of opening their own franchises, and face compliance for new entrants. The idea here on number five is that when a person finishes their qualification via INSITA, they shouldn't still go into the workplace and then try and get their face compliance. We've built all of that into what we have so that when they exit as a compliant person that is fully employable and ready to hit the ground running. Thank you. I trust I covered everything that was set out in the notice. Thanks.
Thank you, Snell. Can I ask a question? What is the total value of the sector, not your kind of your input into it in terms of the funding, but just what is the total if you look at South African economy? And what is the profiling in the sector, in the insurance sector, in terms of the ownership patterns?
The market cap, yeah.
Yeah.
The market cap is about.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure on the market cap, but certainly on the JSE, in the top 20 firms, at least 8 or 9 of them would be financial services companies, and a number of them would be insurance companies. I think also, obviously, in terms of contribution to GDP, financial services is the biggest contributor to GDP out of any sector in the country. They contribute 25% of GDP. So it's a huge engine within the economy. I think a lot of people assume that mining or manufacturing are actually those contributors, but if you look at the latest things from Stats SA, you'll see that financial services are the top. So, yeah, I mean, it's a bit of 80-20 here. The challenge, though, is in employability. You know, when you're talking about the unemployed, as you saw from that slide where you questioned the tertiary component, that's what's required. So the partnerships with universities and the FET colleges are critical to increase employment. But if we're just talking about matriculants and in terms of DTI's codes, and you know, that's challenging.
I mean, the non-banking
yes.
section of financial services. I was the director of Sunlum for 4 years, and in my last look at it was sitting. The market cap is over 100 billion.
Yeah.
Okay, so and Sunlum is what, second, third?
Yeah.
So Old Mutual, Sunlum is a big one. Liberty Life.
Liberty, and in the banks, obviously.
Right. But there are quite a few others, right? Lion of Africa, there's
Collard,
yeah. SAIG.
Yeah. And then the reinsurers as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So the answer to the chairman's question is big.
It is massive, yeah. I mean, the mining companies, by market cap, are the biggest companies, because we hold the biggest resources in the world, gold, platinum, diamonds. But in terms of activity, economic activity, I'd say financial services trumps any of the other sectors.
Would that then not have an impact on your levy income? Because that should then, you know, talk to your levy income.
Yes, I mean, I think what we've seen, what China alluded to, was the resilience in the financial services, and obviously the banks are under the bank seater, but in financial services, you know, we haven't seen the drop-off that we anticipated because people were trying not to lay off people. They were finding new ways of economizing. They weren't having salary increases. They were agreeing salary cuts in some instances. I think you were just recognizing the small pool of skilled people that are there, and to lay them off may mean that they leave the country. So, you know, why cut off your nose to spite your face?
So you're saying that the levy income is roughly 250 million?
But there's no shortage of levy income in this sector. That's quite clear. I think the challenge for us and for most teachers is spending the money. As you're aware, there is a growing cash pile amongst teachers. And it's hard to monitor that spending, but my biggest challenge is underspending.
Just hang on, I thought I wanted to hear from the management of the CETA, operational management, because I also want to test is the sector being led by the industry, or is the sector being led by I'm talking about the CETA, being led by the management structure itself. So if you can just park a little bit on the issue of the levy itself, what percentage, I think you've touched on it earlier, but what percentage are actually not paying? It's 80%.
If I could maybe rephrase to get some understanding, you're looking at
all the companies and the percentage that's not paying.
It's very difficult to say because there's no data on companies that are non-levy paying companies. We have about 1,400 levy paying companies in our sector that contributes to that levy amount. But if you just look at what I said previously, there are over 100,000 burial societies in South Africa. So each burial society as a unit is a company. There's all brokerages all over South Africa, small little brokerages, etc. So the actual numbers in companies is very difficult to assess because they fall outside of your catchment. So it's very difficult to determine the number, but it's far, far in excess of the levy-paying companies. Your one-man, two-man brokerages. Yes.
Example, another 200 million that's not being paid somewhere, that's what I'm trying to understand. If this is 25% of GDP, for example,
yes.
If this is, in your words, one of the largest,
yes.
In terms of market share, what does that all of work what will it then mean in the context of the actual levy and the income to support the sector further? In terms of a developmental agenda. So that's what I'm trying to understand.
Thanks. I'm going to ask Bernard to assist me when I'm done with the completeness of revenue and how we deal with that. But just to touch on the percentage of GDP, here's the financial sector is one-fifth of GDP. But you must remember that the financial CETAs as a conglomerate are bank CETA, facet, and insurance CETA. So we're one-third of one-fifth. In terms of that. And then maybe Bernard can tell you why we regard our revenue as complete and what steps we take to ensure a completeness of revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The revenue, and as you mentioned, there might be a pot that is not contributed within levies. There's a threshold of 500,000 per employer. If your payroll is below 500,000, you are exempt from paying skills development levies. So you might find your smaller brokers that might not contribute to the levy income. The levy income is then SARS assists with the collection of the levy income, and that is then also regulated by SARS.
So this threshold of 500,000 rand and more, what percentage of companies in that threshold would you argue are actually paying their salaries?
I would really honestly guess, I think maybe about 95%. If it is at any particular point of time, it might be because somebody's not registered with SARS, because SARS would determine whether a company should be paying levies or not based on the threshold. So I would say at any given time, it would be close to 100%, but not 100% accurate. But I really think we have reached a point where we can say with certainty that the revenue is fairly complete. What falls out of it is because there's so many small brokerages, if you actually have to look at the number of small brokerages out there that fall outside the threshold and maybe collect levies from them, it would amount to a substantial amount of money, but that's not what the Skills Development Levies Act says.
Okay,
If you look at the training needs in the sector as a whole, I mean, you know, it's organized. There's back offices and front offices. There are brokers out there that are independent and semi-independent and so on. If you look at the full array of training requirements, how much training do you actually provide or support for the sector as a whole, given its demand structure presently? That's the first question. And the second question, can you answer that question by expressing it in terms of money, percentages of money? How much of the funding that you have is spent in the best interest of the individuals being trained, both to get into the business and also the upskilling training that takes place?
Thank you. I don't have those figures immediately available, but most of the 107,000 Rand that would have gotten allocated in that year would go towards training. And one must bear in mind, we also have your ratios to apply, whereby we must make sure most of our funding gets directed to black people, women, and then you find most of the brokers that are out there in your one-man brokerages are most likely white males. So a lot of our funding will go through to people employed in the bigger insurance houses, the black people there, to give them management training, to give them training that are related to scarce and critical skills. So if one is to isolate areas and projects where we're looking at training, it would be a bursary project, it would be learnerships and internship, and maybe some of the projects like FAES. But FAES benefits the whole sector, because you can't run it any other way unless it's a dedicated FAES project for black brokers. So when we put together the training material and the RPL exams, everybody went and wrote the exam, so you didn't really have your demographics coming through. But that's quite an important thing. A lot of the brokers that are out there are white brokers, are white male brokers, and tend to fall outside of the funding because we only allow to fund them at about 15% of available funds.
Follow-up question, Chair. Could you... See, what I'm trying to ascertain is, because you're an intermediate bureaucracy, so you receive money through the National Skills Fund and then you spend that money in service of training. And the key thing is training, right? That's what has to happen. And the different stages of training and so on and so forth. And are you satisfied? I mean, you need to demonstrate to our satisfaction that the majority of the money that you have goes towards training. Okay, and it's not there to essentially create a fat bureaucracy, because that worries us. So, and you must find a way of expressing that in figures. And if you're cash rich and you can't spend your money, then we've got a further problem, because you're not only supposed to respond to, as a CETA, to the demand in the private sector. Because if you simply do that, then you simply satisfy the private sector. There has to be a vision for how you train new people, and especially black people and other formerly disadvantaged people, to get into that sector. And so what is that? I mean, how are you training, are you supporting the development of new entrepreneurs in the sector? Because the private sector in this business is dominated as it is by big companies. And so how does a new person break into that sector? If you can't answer that question now, we'd like that answer at some point.
I think we can all answer that question, maybe little bits of it. Yes, the admin expenditure is restricted to 10%. So we don't take admin expenditure out of the 107,000 that was allocated to discretionary grant funding. So those projects are directed at training. And certainly more than half of it goes to unemployed black youth, because that is a key area for INSETA, to get people into the sector, to increase the profile of the sector, and to access employability via your learnerships, and for those that have already graduated via your internships. And then the new thing for us now, we've always offered bursaries for employed people, obviously based on the demographics as well, but in the past 12 months, we started offering bursaries for unemployed people in the scarce and critical area. So the majority of the CETA's funding, when it comes to training, is going to the right demographic group, it is going to youth, and it is going to unemployed people. Insofar as new venture training is concerned, this has been an area that has baffled the CETAs, more specifically the insurance CETA. And our problems are to start something new in insurance. You need huge amounts of capital, which new ventures don't have. We looked at supplementary activities that you can start a new venture in, and we have identified those activities, your small service brokerages, etc. But you're never going to get a new insurance house via a new venture. Having accepted that, we then looked at other ways of doing it. New ventures has not been successful with us. And we look at success as if you go 12 months afterwards, you must still find your business in operation. And we haven't achieved that measure of success. And it's been a burning problem for a lot of CETAs, the creation of new ventures. And that has a lot to do with strategic partners. I don't know if my colleagues want to add anything to my response.
Okay, I just wanted to allude to a project that we had with Sanlam, where they were addressing the problem of new ventures. Roping in people that would otherwise have lost their jobs, they started a project where they were starting them on franchises. And INCETA was involved in that project, in the funding of that project, for them to be able to start those franchises. So that was our way of contributing to creation of new ventures. These were people that were already employed in the sector but would have lost their jobs had Sanlam not intervened. And INCETA went into partnership that way. But taking someone outside of the CETA, outside of the sector, someone who was previously employed and starting a financial house or an insurance brokerage, it's number one, there are phase-related restrictions in that a person cannot just come and become a broker. Number two, there are those restrictions also of who are you going to be getting your clients from, because clients want someone who is competent, who is able to manage their funds. So it becomes a process for a person in the insurance sector to really start a new venture and be successful. Otherwise, the other projects that we were doing in new venture creation was really supporting functions that are not entirely insurance specific, but that would be supportive to the insurance sector. Those succeeded a lot, but not those that were insurance specific from scratch, from people that were previously not employed in the sector.
Can I
get clarity, and then we'll go on to the questions, because we're zooming in on a particular question or two. Of the 107 million rand of discretionary, understanding what the chief operating officer explained, what percentage of that would you argue, with all the reasons that you've advanced, would therefore go into, of the discretionary, not the mandatory, would therefore go into a link that's in partnership with the bigger companies, to established institutions?
It's very difficult to give an answer.
Remember, it's the third time that you're saying this today.
If I can understand your question correctly,
differently put, mandatory, understand it.
Yes.
It goes back to the
yes.
companies,
yes.
right, in terms of the way they apply. Discretionary, on the back of questions that we've probed earlier in responses, on the discretionary side, now you train people. You explained that there's white brokers outside, or the majority or so of the individual, it's white brokers, and therefore you've gone into partnership with established companies, and you made the example of one or two of them. So the percentage of the discretionary money, not the mandatory fund, would you argue that 50%, 2%, or 70% of the discretionary money would be channeled through that strategy that's in partnership with the bigger companies?
I'm just going to speak loud.
We have a new venture project that deals with what my colleague Tumi was talking about, where we're in partnership with the company. But one must bear in mind that companies benefit on all our projects. So if one's asking the question, how much of funds go to employed, that's to people in a company that are employed, and how much goes to unemployed, that would certainly have been something we could have done a quick workout at the office and given you accurate percentages. But if I've got to hazard a guess, I would almost say it would be about 50-50 to what portion of our discretionary funds goes to unemployed people, new people coming into the sector, and what portion goes to existing people that are employed in companies.
I thought that was the question.
Okay.
The question is, here's the mandatory grant. That goes to companies, fund loans, the old mutuals, and anyone else in the medium players and the smaller ones that pay the levy can apply, and they will get a percentage back. Is that right? Then you've got discretionary funds that can be, that goes into a developmental strategy. What I'm hearing you said earlier is that even the discretionary fund is being used in partnership with those type of companies.
I want to know what is the percentage of the 107 million rand that goes into that type of strategy. Not in terms of those that's employed and those that's unemployed. Is the largest part of the discretionary also going into that process?
I wouldn't say the largest part going to that. I'd say it's roughly 50-50 from the discretionary fund. 50 going to unemployed people and 50 going to the companies. Because we run employed learnerships as well, but most of it is unemployed learnerships, unemployed interns coming into the sector on our programs. From bursary projects, huge beneficiaries would be employed bursaries, people that are employed in the sector as well, and then a portion of that would be unemployed. But we can work out some figures for the committee, knowing, you know, what the question is, and be able to provide that information.
Chair and members, without diving into the detail project by project, I know that the lion's share of the funding goes towards learnerships and towards internships and bursary funding.
On the discretionary
grant.
Now, the way it goes, how does it go?
I defer to management here, but my understanding as a council member, not wanting to get into too much detail, is that the bulk of that would go to the levy paying companies, and of that, there would be a component that goes to unemployed learners and a component that goes to employed learners.
Members, you hear that question and the response. There is a split in terms of CETA funding that would be 80 or the kind of 10% on admin, 20% levy, 20% is it discretionary, and 50% mandatory. Of the 50% mandatory, that in any case goes to companies. Of the 20% discretionary, what I'm hearing here is that even the bulk of that will go to the companies. That's essentially the point that I wanted to drive home. That, in a sense, negates a developmental agenda in the context of change in that process. If, and understand it's a very difficult industry. Let's know there's high level of professionalism, high-end skills. We assume all of that in a sense. And therefore the question is, what is the strategy? What I'm picking up, the strategy is to swim with the system. And it's not necessary to unpack and unbundle that. That's it. Let's park that. Mimo Kabele, welcome here, but your hand is not first up. I've noted that. Mimo Mishwana, and yourself, Wendy, and then Ms. Lawson, and then Makabele. But I will. We'll get the responses from as the questions come.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. My question is, if your high levy goes to these high levy paying companies, because that's how I understand it, if they get a bigger share because they pay more, that if I understand it correctly, how are you assisting? Because as you spoke, you were like talking of remote areas in your I think it's your values, your vision, like I think I'm confused there. Because they are not giving you much, for sure. They are not producing, but they need to be assisted by big companies like you. How do you make that right, if I may say that? That's my first question. And I'm looking at your represent. Yeah, the council is fine because, of course, you spoke of three. You are like having your whites, your Indians, and blacks. And if you put them together, it's like it's 50-50. But one is checking if that's correct, the way it's done here. Versus the management. Because it's like the management is fine, but it doesn't matter what happens in the council. Unless if it's the way I see it, are you going to balance the hassle? Thank you.
Perhaps I'll get Terence to take the second question. In terms of the first question, what we're speaking to is the big companies know how to run learnerships. They can quite comfortably take our unemployed learners in, deliver qualification, and at 70% employability into the company itself or the broader insurance industry. Our challenge is there are lots of learners in rural areas that are not getting opportunities in the insurance sector. Yet one can find an insurance broker there. The broker doesn't have the capacity to take on a learnership. So, and also your training providers are not prepared to go out in the remote areas and run a learnership. And that's why we're looking at a partnership to deliver a learnership with the FET colleges together with the small brokerages in the area. So therefore, expanding the capability of the rural areas and the small brokers in the rural areas to deliver learnerships. And certainly, and Tumi can speak more to this, your funeral houses, your small brokerages in the area as well, they don't automatically have capacity to run a learnership. But by delivering them a product together with the FET colleges, and they just host from a practical point of view, means we can create more opportunities for people in the rural areas. That is what I was referring to when I was talking specifically to that. And then the second issue is we don't just take unemployed via learnerships. We also take unemployed through internships. That means you first get your qualification and then you get into the brokerage to do your internship. And our view is that those qualifications are not being offered in the rural area. A learner has to come up here to do it. So we want the FET colleges to, public FETs to offer it there. So the learner stays at home, doesn't have unnecessary expenses, do their qualification 1 or 2 years, come out of it, and go into a small brokerage in the area to serve your internship. And that's one way of increasing the number of people that the sector can accommodate and absorb. Mm-hmm. Because certainly a small black brokerage can take a learner in or an intern in if they're being assisted. And chances are that person then will find employment because he'd understand the business and he would be able to then also service the community in that area.
Okay. Just to elaborate on what Sharon was saying, when you look at the exposure to work that the learners are getting from smaller brokers, it's not really much. You compare the learner who has been in a bigger company, exposed to workplace experience in a bigger company, to that who has been exposed to a smaller brokerage, they didn't do the same qualification. So what we are encouraging our smaller employers to do is, we've got a database of learners. When they finish learnership, they give us the companies would give us the names of the learners that were taken, given full-time employment after the learnership, and the remainder, the ones that were competent but did not get employment, we say to the smaller brokers, these are the people that you could host, give employment and train for a year while we pay for them to be skilled in what is, whatever it is that the company, the smaller broker, is doing. In that way, we are thinking we are not disadvantaging the learner in that they've got, yes, the same, let me say, short-term insurance certificate, but the one who's from Old Mutual has more experience in that he was exposed to more, whereas the one who was in, with a smaller broker didn't get that exposure. So we're saying to smaller brokers, we will support these learners to get to know your business by giving them internships, funding. But we do not really, really encourage bigger, smaller companies to take on learnerships because we are thinking about what the learners are getting out of here. We are looking at the quality of the qualification that the learner is and the exposure to workplace that the learner is getting because we really want the learners to come out of there the same, with the same quality of exposure and the same quality of what the other learners are getting. So most of the bigger companies are not really getting the learnership funding because the funding goes to the learners that are being taken by bigger companies. These are unemployed learners that are hosted by bigger companies. It doesn't mean that the companies are getting the learners. When you look at where learnership funding goes to,
doesn't mean that the companies get
the funding. The learnership funding goes to payment of learner stipends and payment of training providers.
And the training providers in that case were not being identified by the company.
They are being identified by the company.
That's the point. That's exactly our point.
But my argument is the money doesn't go to the company. It goes to the training provider and to the learner.
You understand? Who's part of you?
Pardon?
The very trainer. Are they not part of?
The training providers are those that are giving qualifications in the sector and are accredited to give training in the sector.
Who identifies them?
They are identified by the employers, but they have been accredited by training by INSITA to say these are the people that can offer those qualifications.
We understand. We understand the point. You're actually affirming something that you are in terms of the discussion. I think there was a question around the council.
Through you, Chair, to the member. I just want to check the question is, management seems to be very representative of the demographics of the country, but the council is not as representative. Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay. In response to that, I'd say various bodies, and clearly there's a 50-50 split between labour and business, and then one state representative. As far as I understand, that's how all CETA councils are made up. So from the point of view of business, I don't think there's an issue. The representativity there is good. The main issue lies from the labour and the state's point of view. That's where the bulk of the half of the council's white representatives come from. So you've seen the demographics of the employers, which is around 60-40 black-white. I'd say on council, from a business perspective, business is representative in a similar way. Of the seven white council representatives, two of them are from business. The rest are from the state and from labour.
Yeah, actually, that's my concern.
Yeah,
you see,
it's my concern too.
Yeah, but in South Africa, I understand that there may be businesses that treat that with, if we talk of color treat, maybe most of the people. But you see, we need to we rely on people like you to change this culture, because we've got a lot of blacks out there. They need to be assisted to be. If you talk of balances, if you talk of percentages, it's not fair. Actually, there must come a stage when you have assisted those who are not there, the color that's not appearing there, then we'll be in the right. Because to you, if it's 7-7, it's fair, but it's not. Because if you take the 17 million, not the 49, I'm not talking about the 49 million people, only 17 million went to vote in this country, you'll find that most of them will be far less represented to you. So that it looks okay because it's 7-7, but it shouldn't be 7-7, that's what I'm trying to ask.
It's deeply concerning to me as well, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
What we are saying, if your vision, and I'm coming to Ms. Nelson. If your vision is saying and supporting the country's transformation, it's quite a loaded point. And would you therefore argue, in reflection, not in terms of what you want to do into the future, is that affirming in terms of your the operations currently? Was it actually working against it? I think that's an issue there. Meaning, is the buzz worth it, or and the practice is non-existent in that space? In if you look at demonstrate our truly transformed new South African organization should and does operate, does that reflect? And in fact, I would want to suggest to Member Mushwana, even at the management level, it would be a problem,
yeah,
because it doesn't reflect that issue.
Yeah.
So if you've got a sector here that is it one-fourth in terms of the GDP and the inputs, etc., understanding that this particular sector doesn't capture all of that, I think you've tried to explain that, but one can then draw the analysis even further in that. If that translates then into the operations, and I want to say to I think, Ms. Peel, that it's like any company, if, for example, there's a big construction work going around, then in any case you need laborers. So the issue is not the laborers. The issue is in the supply process of the delivery of that product. When we are speaking CETA, we assume learnerships. We assume beneficiary to unemployed individuals. We assume lower-end skill being trained. We assume all of that. So to respond, I think, to that question by raising the point around the actual benefit doesn't go to the company, where I'm sitting is quite mischievous in terms of that response. Because, in fact, if the employer identifies even those providers, because we know if a learnership, there must be people, there must be bodies. Differently put, who's supplying all the catering? For example, when it comes to that process, is it empowered? Is it a new venture running it, or is it not? How does the state money impact in a developmental trajectory? Analysis was made in 1994 that 14% of the South Africa on the stock exchange was then in the hands of the white Afrikaner. Today is at least 44%. So what has happened, and how do we then intervene in the state, as the state, to use some of this to empower the disadvantaged in a developmental process? Now nothing that I've heard today speaks to any of those things in terms of strategic intent. It in a sense understand, and let's get the money out, even the discretionary money. Let's get even the discretionary money out, in the context of the way we are doing the rest. Because, yes, we will then get quality. We will get 70%. If we need to bedevil this further, you know the relation between the companies, training providers, and labor brokering, even in the sector, in terms of the take-up. So if we start to analyze that a little bit further, in terms of just the way, for example, the employment opportunities then will kick in. And are we then in a cycle that takes us forward, or actually in a cycle that doesn't take us forward? And those are the real hard issues that this issue needs to be zoomed in. Member Nelson.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think the issue I wanted to speak on is I want to take a bit further as well. It's still on, your footprint is in Gauteng, it's in Western Cape, it's in, and it, we come back to the rural areas, rural development, transformation that the chairperson is speaking about. You have indicated that you are now going into partnerships with the FETs. How many of the provinces, there's six provinces where you don't really have any footprint. How many of these provinces have been, or what one should actually say, do you have a strategic plan to address these rural areas? you're saying you're working with FETs. How many of these FETs have been approached? Are there programs? We also know that these learnerships are used sometimes just for to have extra hands within companies, and it doesn't add any value whatsoever. So what monitoring mechanisms do you have in place? The learnerships, as I say, the internships, how do you monitor this? Can you at the end of a financial year say, of an X amount of money that we have invested, we have so many graduated people that we can put, that really can add value, that we have really skilled, not just hands doing work, and after the 12-month period, off they go and another new lot come into, because we often find this happening, companies just using these learnerships as hands to do work within organizations or within companies. Thanks, Chair.
Do you want to respond?
Thank you, Chair. Since last year, we started visiting FET colleges countrywide. We went to Limpopo. We went to the Northwest and addressed the FET colleges that are there. We went to the Eastern Cape. We didn't come to the Western Cape because we've got already FET colleges that are doing projects with us in the Western Cape. And the common thing that came out of that was that much as they would like to come on board, they have never offered insurance-related, insurance-specific qualifications. So what we then did was come up with a project, which is only going to be starting next year, once council approves it, that we, in this project, capacity build FET colleges for them to be able to come on board and start at least offering at least one of our qualifications to start off with. And we looked at a qualification which your BCom lecturers would be able to lecture on without them having to get an insurance-specific qualification. And on top of that, also, we looked at capacity building of the lecturers themselves to become assessors and moderators. And in that process, we also encouraged FET colleges to partner with the smaller training providers in that they have been in the sector for a long time and they have they are the experts in insurance. For them to mentor their assessors and moderators, for instance, if they say to them, we give you a contract for a year to come on board with us, once our facilitators have been trained as assessors, for you to do assessments and moderation with them so that they get used to what is being done in the sector. So far, we have we had good response from them, but their directorate said to us, they will identify the colleges that would be ready to kick off with us, because not all of them have that capacity. Not all of them would be able to offer our qualification.
Okay. Can I add the last point there? Just from a number point of view, for the previous financial year that ended now, 27,547 workers completed learning programs.
And just as a matter of interest, what has happened to those 27,000? Have they just entered an exodus? So can you track them?
Those are the people that are employed in the sector. They are workers in the sector, so they remain in the sector. Given percentage fluctuations of people finding other jobs, etc., but they are workers in the sector.
Just as my follow-up, would discretionary funds not be exactly which man is speaking about?
To use discretionary funds in order to make a meaningful difference, in order to, that in my mind would say, use discretionary funds to for transformation, to get into FETs, to develop programs in order, and not put it into existing, you know, where funds are already going, but to use it to develop and to make a meaningful change. Thanks, Chair.
Can we continue? The point is, that has been assessed for now. Member McBurney.
Thanks, Chair. We also have got a document here that indicates the names of companies and those that we have entered into some memorandum of understanding and so on. I take it with FHEs, it's limited at that. There's been no training based on the information that has just come. But also goes on to saying in all those companies, you don't know their status, BEE status. And I'm just wondering, how do you accept these companies? Because to me, upon registration, you needed to be able to ascertain that immediately, so that at the point that whether you will be doing your procurement or whatever services you would need and so on, or assistance that you should give in the event you need to give them some assistance, you needed to know, so that it's based on your own criteria as to who are you dealing with and so on. But I think you will come to that later on. Chair, I'm just interested in the CITAS transformation kind of targets, what we wanted to achieve, by when, and what progress you have made in that particular regard. It will be a broader response that I'm expecting from you, including, for instance, if you needed entry into this kind of field by people with disabilities, for instance, what have you done, how far are you, and so on. Can we talk to such a kind of targets and tell us as to what happened? On the discretionary grant, I take it that you're saying plus minus 60% of the overall goes to mega companies. I'm looking at the 50 mandatory and the 20%, which upon that 20%, about 10%, if we're talking 50%, goes into bigger companies. And you're trying to justify why is that. Perhaps I wanted to get this question across so that you clarify me on what is actually happening. You have said that in most of the other provinces, you've got brokerages that are very small. So probably they're not paying levies. And you'll have most of these companies which are big, based in Gauteng, probably their head offices. If you're talking old mutual, it will be either here in the Western Cape or in Gauteng, but then it's across the country. So you will be treating them as a bigger company, probably based in Gauteng. And you're saying that in terms of training, you're not dealing with those small companies in the main, because the majority of the employees that you must train, which must get into learnerships and so on, will be going to these bigger companies. Then what happens to those that may be employed by these small companies? You think you're not encouraging them either to take learnerships, because in your view, they don't have capacity to do that. But the broader question in all that is, my take is that your criteria, sort of, is biased towards bigger companies. And you'll never have these small companies being pulled up, you know, to the level where they can compete in the industry. At what point are you looking at that? I'm not saying it will be by tomorrow that you may have some small company all of a sudden competing with either Sanlam or whatever. I'm not necessarily saying that. But I'm saying the view, this developmental program we're talking about, should look at the situation where at some point you make the environment conducive for everybody to do business and to compete almost still at a higher level. At what point are we looking at assistance in that particular regard? Because the way it is, it will mean it will move like that forever. Just share with us as to your program's impact, or since you've been there, what impact have you made which is going to assess what happened after you have actually trained these people. Did you ever do any analysis or any study that tells you, yes, people were in this employ, so they've been there already as workers, but what happened after training? Did you ever check that, or they remaining within their own levels where there were no real promotions, nothing as a result of the training, or some skill that shows, or some progress that says, after training these people, if it was a small company, for instance, where you might have pulled 2-3 people and trained, what happened in terms of that particular company? Did it somewhat sustain and achieve good results as opposed to before training and so on? Are you able to share with us of some study that you might have made? You talked RPL. Probably the modules you're using have been accredited. I don't know. Perhaps in this particular regard, you might have linked with SAQA in terms of all your programs. When you're talking FET and the programs that you wanted to handle, obviously it can't be council alone and the FET agreeing into some memorandum of understanding to start teaching those particular modules. I think SAQA should be on board to understand what you offer. And by now, probably they may be on board. But I wanted you to share with us on this RPL thing as to what you've been able to do, because probably it may be a success story, but across the country, there are difficulties in that particular regard, and it will be an interesting thing to know that you have been able to succeed in that particular regard. Just the last point. Career guidance project that we have shown in one of the documents here takes about 1.6 million. Just on printing documents, which we want to distribute across the country, I think it's a lot of money. If it's just meant for printing leaflets and just distributing them, other than that money going into, I think we can have better ways of sharing information and so on and so on than just printing. Because it may then go back to what we said earlier, that you might have hide this money, reinvest it for printing and just give it to some company to just print a lot of documents and just giving them business. But as to whether that will have impact in terms of people out there to be able to come on board, I'm doubtful whether that will be the most effective mechanism that we can use. Chair, I might have taken some time, but the very last one is on restrictive entry that is there by this particular industry. Unless we deal with that, it will be a very serious problem. Let's take the pharmacy kind of industry. Of late, it's not a must that in order to run a pharmacy, you need to be a pharmacist. You know, you can run that business. Even other business, I don't want to go on and on. But on this particular one, people must first have qualifications, which in the main, the environment is still dictated by bigger companies. You know, so it will mean we must be restricted on those that are available, and the environment is not user-friendly. It remains very, very restricted. At what point are we going to break that? Or you may, whether in writing or now, share with us how you think we can be able to broaden or widen the scope of entry. Yes, people should have interest on their own to come on board and so on, but also when they are in there, they don't get frustrated, like it happens with the chartered accountants and so on, where you can't actually have any major progress, regardless of being in the new South Africa and so on, there are many things for politics in there. In this particular environment, how do we actually make a dent, a serious dent, to ensuring that transformation is taking place, unlike what is happening thus far. Thanks, Chair. I think you have been very kind.
Thank you. I'm going to address one or two of the things, Honourable Member. The first is related to the list of accredited training providers. One must remember that we keep records of training providers as an education, training, and quality authority ourselves, to quality assure the learning that the training provided delivers in the sector, and we go out and ensure and make sure as an external moderation before the records are loaded onto the National Learner Record Database. We don't keep records of training providers for the purposes of preferential procurement. They are not our partners in preferential procurement. They are our partners for the purposes of we are their authority, and that's why we have them here. In terms of our funding, we don't have training providers who we provide funds to, and that's why I've put there.
Are you saying that the preferential procurement policy doesn't kick in when around your example, this list that Emma McBella speaks to?
Maybe you can clarify what I'm saying. I first started off by saying, as an ETQ, as a training authority, we are the authority of the training providers. So we register all training providers who we regard as being able to meet the requirement and deliver that standard of training. And we go out and monitor their training and assist them to load it on the NLRD once we've done the external verification of their training to make sure the training is done correctly. We are a quality assurance body. So we do not engage with training providers for the purposes of supply chain management, preferential procurement. That's when our other providers kick in. And we said in terms of the big projects where we do deliver training, learnerships, internships, and bursaries, the policy is not designed along the training provider. The policy is designed to provide the funding to the employer company. And the providers who we engage with in terms of our policies are public FETs and public universities. So if we want to do a customized program in terms of our bursary policy, we'll go to a public FET or we'll go to a university. And that is a result of all the problems we experience with engaging various training providers in terms of our SWOT analysis. So we don't keep BEE records of training providers in our ETQA division. We just keep their normal registration records as training providers with us.
So you don't assist them?
It's not done in terms of preferential procurement. And that is to explain why we're saying their BEE status is unknown. So if you come to our supply chain division and you want to pick up on a provider that renders services to INSETA, all the preferential requirements are met. We've got all the details, who the director is, etc. Those things are there. And that's why I'm trying to explain. When you ask for my accredited providers, that's why I don't have all of those things for you.
So you're saying it is there?
No, it's not there because they are not suppliers to INSETA. They are registered training providers. They're accredited with us and they're registered to deliver learning in the sector.
Do they get money from INSETA?
No.
Where do they get money?
They like a normal institution that goes out the MOPOC business school source business from people.
So INSETA doesn't give money to training providers?
No. So we work with public FETs and universities, and where the we're doing learnerships, learnership stipends get paid over to the employer companies.
In the portfolio committee of higher education, the chief operating officer says that funding of this teacher is not paid out to training providers.
That's correct.
That's one. Secondly, in terms of paying the discretionary process, that, and therefore you don't have the record, you are then saying it's only paid out to public education institutions.
For example, our bursary policy opens up funding windows for employer companies to apply for bursaries. They would apply for a bursary, they would source their provider, and INSETA would pay the employer company in two tranche payments. Discretionary. And then we then do programs for non-levy paying companies, we do programs for BE companies, unemployed, etc., via service level agreements with public HETs and public FETs.
So the discretionary discretionary funds outside of those universities that here and there, because I don't think that's the bulk of that funding. You're then saying that then also is being dealt with through the employer organization.
Yes.
In the discretionary fund.
That's right.
And you don't have a record of that because all that you are looking at is in a levy for income.
No, we have proper records of bursaries that we issue.
No. I'm talking about the question about, say, status.
Of the training provider that the employee company is. No, we don't keep records of that. But we have records of all training providers who are registered with us as training providers to deliver learning.
And you don't have the status?
No. As you see, in one or two places, we answered a guess because we knew the people involved. But we don't keep BE records of that. Standard providers of Incita, yes, we have their records because it affects payments.
Meaning that even if people registered and never got employed, it was the business as usual, just as you said. Those big companies having their own association with the service provider, their own people, they'll just run like that forever.
Is it possible that we can go into the records, even of those companies, only to find that they employed either former white companies, and it was just like that for the past 10 years that we have been in operation?
That might well be the case. We don't ask in our bursary policy when giving a bursary. We don't have a prescription that the employer company must go and use a BEE training provider. We just say accredited training provider. Sorry, do you have something?
In this regard, when you talk transformation, what are you talking about?
In CETA's transformation initiatives, and we have a lot, does not extend indirectly in that measure. We provide bursaries on scarce and critical skills, and there's a suite of training providers that have opportunities available, which the companies can choose from. We don't extend and say the company must then make sure that they're using a BE training provider. Our responses in terms of transformation relates to our initiatives in terms of the people that are trained. We make sure that the right demographics are trained, the companies are training the right demographics. We make sure black people are getting management training. We make sure women are receiving management and leadership training, disabled people, etc. And the other training initiatives we have with our insurance BE companies. So if an insurance company is a BE company, if the insurance company is a SMME company, we go out and train them and give them special preference in terms of projects. But we don't extend to training companies who are registered with the ETDP CETA and make sure that those people as well are looked after from that point of view. We respond to insurance sector, not to training providers who fall under ETDP CETA.
Can you continue answering the other question?
Okay.
I just want to clear one question that you asked. You talked about RPL. I didn't mention any RPL in what I was talking about. I was talking about capacity building of FET colleges because they have never trained in our sector. But that won't be RPL.
The question, I don't know who referred to, but there was RPL mentioned. It might not have been you, but not RPL. You talked RPL.
What's the RPL strategy currently that the CETA is engaged on?
The RPL strategy would be in line with the SOCA requirements for RPL.
What are you doing practically?
Can I answer? We had opportunity with the phase assessments where we put an RPL program, and the reason, therefore, is that the brokers had existing knowledge of the required fit and proper requirements, but because the training requirement came about as a result of the FACE Act, they didn't have the credits. So what we put in place was a special RPL assessment, which we rolled out nationally in all the 9 provinces, whereby brokers who had existing knowledge could go and write a special RPL exam to obtain the 30 and 60 credit that was required by FASE. And then all our programs, everything that the CETAs deliver, any training provider delivers, has an RPL component in it. So if a person wants to do it or get some of the credits via RPL, the RPL policy is in process, and it's governed by SACWA, so that's pretty standard. And I just want to say that CETA has green status with SACWA. So everything we do is at almost the highest level there in terms of RPL.
Yeah, thank you. I think somebody mentioned going to FETs in Limpopo, and what did you? Yeah, and like they are not doing insurances. What have you done to change that around? Because it's like it's very important that we have it, even especially in those remote areas, not Limpopo only, but Bono, Saint Cape of this world, this other. Are you doing something about it? And even before I respond, we appreciate if we see women pushing companies like this, we definitely want to see you succeed. Maybe that's why I'm asking these questions.
Thank you. We have come up with a project that would support the FET colleges, as I mentioned earlier. And we wanted a qualification that they would be able to already start running with, where the BCom lecturers would be able to come on board with. We have already 2 FET colleges in Northwest, Vuselela College, and one in Richards Bay, Umfolozi College, that have already come on board with lecturing our insurance specific qualifications. But the other ones that are only now going to be starting to come on board, we have a project for funded by discretionary grants that is going to be supporting the FET colleges to, number one, develop materials for them, because that was the first complaint, that, number one, we're not experts in this. So we're going to be developing materials for them so that we standardize the delivery that they'll be giving. Number two, from that project, we will be capacitating them with becoming assessors and moderators. And that is where I mentioned that partnership that we would encourage between them and the experts in the sector to mentor them until they come to a level where they will be able to run by themselves.
Can I? I think there was one hand, Emma James. Okay. Can I suggest the following? Just back to this. What is this? This name of company, accreditation number, allocation, and so on. What is this?
There was a notice that was sent to us, and the notice required that we provide
the name of the providers and their status.
Yeah, it says that it's a list of all your training providers,
yeah,
their BE status, including allocation budget spend.
And why didn't you give the allocation?
Because we are the ETQA, we don't allocate to them funding.
Members, Mr. Wynn. If a government entity, by virtue of the taxpayers' money, do they need to comply with a broad thrust of the principles that the state has? For example, it's the very first CETA that I'm hearing. It's a ETQA body, and therefore we're not supposed to look to the following. What is the policy here?
Chair, thanks. Based on what you've said, if one looks at the requirements of the Skills Development Act, if you look at the principles of the National Skills Development Strategy, then I think what you have emphasized, must be adhered to and must be implemented by the CETAs, when we are talking about BEE, your employment, your equity requirements and all those type of issues. So as far as the department is concerned, legislation is concerned, CETAs must ensure and they must basically manage accordingly.
Can I then say that, you see, I think this is possibly the nicest example about an unqualified audit and a complete disregard for a developmental approach in terms of performance management. Because, we consistently speak about, because the easier thing is to get an unqualified audit just to make sure that the system runs, especially if you've got your Deloitte and your all those other auditing firms, for example, with you. That's the easiest part. The difficult part is how do you actually empower black brokers? And from a CETA, that's in a sense a primary responsibility, from a developmental process that you need to engage on. What I'm going to suggest, members, is that clearly we're going to have to reflect on this particular submission. You've heard what, and I hope it was noted, what the response of the department were. So there's supposed to be adherence to those things. It is not an issue of we just need to disperse the money and not worry about how the money impacts on our societal responsibility. Based on your own vision, your own mission, your own statements in terms of what you've articulated. If I go to this list, there's only one other province, other, in terms of now I'm speaking about the providers here, other than the Western Cape, Gauteng, and KZN, and it is the Eastern Cape. So if you actually go page by page here, you will see none on page one for any other province than those three provinces. If you look at page two, it's only one G West, for example, in Eastern Cape. If you go to page three, it's two. If you go to page four, it's one. If you go to page five, it's naught. Now, clearly, there's something wrong. If the council and its management are not reflective of this. Also, I think you didn't deal with the issue of provincial investment. If you take your money, and how does it land into every province? How many learners are from specific provinces? That alignment has not happened. So what I'm going to request you, there's a few questions here. Some of the questions members have already raised. And I hope you've made notes of that to in a sense, be able to give us a response. But one, give us a breakdown also of your regional advisors and its demographic breakdown. I hope you're noting these things. Two, the mandatory grants, the name of companies in order of beneficiation of the mandatory grants, and the allocation and the broad-based status in terms of the DGI principles. Then also the actual value, as well as the training providers and their status. On the discretionary side, part you've raised three areas. You've raised, or at least two that I've picked up. The one is to public institutions, and the other one is to the employers, organizations, levy paying. Do that breakdown per institution. If you take the public sector, the value of that 107 million in the last financial year, the value thereof, and the value of the public sector, say the FET college or the university, etc., that and the actual program, as well as in the private sector in terms of the on the discretionary, again that same question that linked up the mandatory. So it's the value on the discretionary that went to employee organizations. Who are those employee organizations? And then also, what is their status in terms of the state's responsibility when it comes to the skills development legislation, as well as the national skills development strategy?
and the policy that, in a sense, gave birth to you. Because you are saying it's the companies, but go there and who was the principal provider of the service in those companies. So that we also want, right? In the provincial allocations, if you take South Africa, there's 9 provinces. Give us, for example, money spent in each of those provinces, both from the mandatory and the discretionary, and give us the actual programs and the number of beneficiaries in terms of the number of people, as well as the status on providers there. Give us also on the number of, if I look at the plan to support, in a sense that you say that non-levy paying, what is the actual strategy for the non-levy paying companies? What was it in the last financial year? What money was spent on them? What was the programs that were spent on them? And even if there's none, or if there's only one, that's fine, but give us that. And what, therefore, is the plan for this financial year, including the next financial year? Not the vision, but the actual plan of that. Plan to support black brokers, as well as the non-levy paying entities. That's both a plan and a strategy in terms of the rollout. That including the other question that's being raised. There was a question on RPL, which I think you recognize the response. I actually stopped the member to the honourable member to ask a follow up on that. I requested not to. But if you can look at the RPL and therefore what capacitation processes have you put in place and are you putting in place on that issue? Now, all of that information is not information that are not supposed to be held by an institution like yourself. It's supposed to be information that you're having. And therefore, I'm going to ask you to make sure that that information reaches us by Tuesday morning, that you thoroughly get into this. It's the first institution that tells us that they're not supposed to adhere to certain of those principles that's driven by the transformation trajectory in terms of the policy of the NSDS tool, including the issue about the skills development legislation. And I'm going to ask you to pull that information for us. And then the committee will obviously reflect on how we take that further. Member?
Thank you, Chairman. I have a slightly different view, and I want to articulate that view, which is that there's something about the architecture of the business that we must understand, and that opportunities for black individuals to get access to the business side of it is constrained by the scale of investment that's required. That is why the minority shareholder of Sanlam is Patrice Matsepe with Ubuntu Butu, and that UB sits on top of a whole range of institutions in black society mobilizing investment funds and insurance. And so that's the one company, and the other company is Fred Robertson's Brimstone's Line of Africa, which is the other black insurance company, then a few others. It's really difficult. A CETA cannot be responsible. It's not a venture capital firm. We can't place that burden on them. So the opportunities would have to be in the area of brokerage. So I think you're right to ask that question. But what the link is between a CETA, which is falls under high education, and the development of brokers, which is an individual entrepreneurship that operates, is a tricky question. And so I must say, I don't think you failed in the development agenda in terms of stimulating growth and so on. And I think
you can certainly do better, but I would hate to see you leave here being scolded by this committee to not doing your job properly.
Can I say
this? The issue here is if you actually, we understand growth trajectory, we understand trickle-down effect, we understand the fact that in order for the economy to grow, we bring a few investments in, and therefore the economy grows. That has shown, not only in South Africa, but in fact internationally, there's real questions about that. And therefore, we are moving from a different perspectives. It's very clear what the developmental state's perspective on this is. It is very clear on the fact that in South Africa, there's a judgment out that said, we were in fact, and when it comes to a little bit of black ownership, etc., in its developmental process, that's a different debate. We are saying, what has the future done here? To support, for example, that layer that falls in the area of vulnerability in the sector. And how did the CETA then manage their plan? All that I can see is you've reaffirmed the obvious. That's what you've done. Now, that surely cannot be the responsibility of a developmental perspective on the state's interventions, which the CETA is part and parcel to. Member?
Just I want to raise two things. The first is just to ensure that the CETA understands what we were seeing on RPN, that they must be able to bring us the success rate on those RPN. I think that's what we would want to see, if there's any particular success in that regard. The second part, Chair, taking it further from what we have just said, I think when we talk transformation, when we talk development, developmental agenda and all that, it can't just be simple things. You go to the extremes. There should be an effort to say we're here, we're moving towards that direction, and now we are here. You can't claim not to be aware of what is going on. Yours is to distribute money. It ends there. It can't be right, you know. So whoever has got this public purse that is charged with the responsibility to distribute, there must be a strategy which talks to that transformation. And if that strategy can't be articulated in this meeting, where else is it going to be articulated? If people can't have that information in their fingertips, you know, that we don't have figures, we are not aware, well, it may be the companies that are much more aware than us, and so on. You are not in charge. You're not, yes, you may think you are not responsible, but you can't give money somewhere else and you are supposed to account, because we can't call those companies to account here. It should be the CETA that says, this is, as far as we know, this is what happened. Either they must get those companies to account to them and say, this is what we are actually doing. Because we'll be surprised, or we may wake up one day after 20 years, 30 years, if that will last till that long, only to find that we have not done anything. It was business as usual, under our nose. You know, how do we allow that kind of a situation? So if we want to live here, Chair, giving an impression that there's nothing wrong, people can go and continue the way they've been doing, I think we're sending a wrong message. That our own people, the only benefit they should have from this sector is in terms of skilling. You can't touch the issue of distribution of money. That would must be left to some other people. Because when you talk transformation, you're talking how resources are to be distributed. Skilling is one part and all that. But at the end of the day, we're talking money, where money goes. And then you must be able to talk to that particular effect if you want to talk transformation. Thank you, sir.
I don't want to use the term particular, but you can't come with this having unknown when you are supposed to, it's either yes or no. But here it's a lot of unknown to the, such that you are entrusted as citizens to make a turnaround for this country. And there's no way you can come here and not know. We need information from this. Actually, we need you to change this country. Definitely, you are entrusted with something very serious. And don't misuse our chance. Thank you.
Surprisingly, yeah, the last page, there's a yes. From the family,
only one yes. Yes.
There's a yes, not the last page. Last but one. There's a yes. And a lot of that can be explained.
Yeah. Yeah.
New era, why would you say yes there, but in every other thing you say no? You wouldn't know.
That's what we said at the beginning. I don't think that's the only one. There might be one or two others, but from personal experience, we know that the company is completely black-owned.
The company?
It's black-owned.
All these companies?
No, the one where we said yes.
Okay. So what we are saying, you're going to take this and you're going to fill it out properly for us, and you're going to do the assessment based on what the provisions of your NSDS 2, as well as the skills development legislation. And the obvious thing, there's no manager in the state that can say, we are, for example, disbursing money and we're not interested if there's broad-based, if there is, for example, change in the patterns of ownership. There is just no way. In fact, it is then precisely against your responsibility as a manager. We cannot sit and say that if you look at, for example, all the construction projects that's running in South Africa, it doesn't really matter as long as there is quality product. Because what we are doing, we are in fact increasing the poverty lines in South Africa. In this sector, the question would be, and that's research that we're going to have to do internally, did we increase by way of, I didn't even touch to understand the regulatory changes that were seen in the last couple of years in the sector. And therefore, did it affirm or did it curtail, for example, your empowering of your brokerage? I remember in the taxi industry when we did, what did we do? We did the licensing of all taxis, you know, from a bottom-up industry where people didn't have a license, they weren't regulated, and suddenly we placed regulation. That process then had to manage that transition, then had to ensure that there is proper empowering of the taxi operators, because remember, it was an industry that was built from the bottom, not from the top. The state didn't really support the taxi industry. And in doing that, it means certain responsibilities. So we're going to ask you to go back, to urgently convene your meetings, your management meeting, and your council meeting, and to report to us by Tuesday morning. That then we are meeting on Wednesday, and that will then dictate how do we take this further. We are very clear that the banks, this transformation, and there's some people that has bought equities in there. That's not our interest, because we're not dealing here with the individuals having ownership in banks, individuals having ownership in financing houses. That's not our issue. If there's a name called Tokyo, if there's a name called Fred, or there's a name called, what was the other one? Patrice. Those things, for example, in the context of a developmental process for us, would not be our overriding, and that's not what the member raised. I'm taking the debate a little bit beyond that. Hence, what we are interested in is, how does this 200 and, what is it, 50 million rand actually change the patterns of development and the patterns of ownership and break from the past? Because this sector is possibly one of the least transformed sectors in our society. And are we then saying that the theater in its implementation on only the discretionary fund, even support the old approach in terms of the least transformed? And that's what we are getting here to. So what I'm going to ask you is to go back, put this for us together. I'm at the point in this engagement where, in fact, it's most probably better that if we need to in fact engage a parliamentary process, because all that we've done up to now, we've in a sense asked for briefings, we got briefings, we could see some of the red flags in the space, and we're asking for corrective measures. If we are able to get that by Tuesday morning, it's good. If we're not, then obviously we will see in what way we bring our legislative authority in to enforce adherence if there's no adherence. In fact, is this the debate where we are saying, because if the management surely rests on we are able to disburse money, anyone can disburse money if you've got good auditing processes happening. But is that really only the responsibility of citizens of Africa? And clearly we know it's not. Even if that was the assumption until a year and a half ago, if the CETA has read every point that was made in Parliament, by the President, by the Minister of Higher Education and Training, by the Director General, by the NSDS Draft 3, what is your, in a sense, turnaround strategy? Is this a turnaround strategy that you've embarked about in January, and clearly that's not? Does the turnaround strategy need another turnaround strategy, and that is what you're going to have to internally go and confront yourself with? So with that, I really would want to excuse yourselves and indicate that from where we are sitting, clearly this is not, we cannot have a situation where any manager in any CETA tells us that in fact we're not supposed to look at the issues that was requested, and not say us looking at it, but where you are sitting, because that's obvious in fact in any environment where there's public purpose related to it. For that, I want to thank you, and then we would want to continue with the rest of our agenda.
Thank you. Thanks to the members.
Thanks. Shall we immediately look at members? It's now 12 o'clock. In fact, we were supposed to have two seaters, and we then fortunately decided on one only. In fact, it was really by default. Wasn't there a request from the one seater not to be here today? So it wasn't, in fact, planned in that way. But members, you've got quarterly performance with it. Did you give out that? If you can just go to... Members, there's a letter.